I'm Marty Moscowen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. Coming up on today's show, we'll hear from three novelists about their life and their work. We'll listen to Mary Cummings Jordan's interview with Nicole Dennis Benn, author of Here Comes the Sun. The novel is an examination of her native Jamaica and of colorism. We'll also hear my discussion with Salim Haddad, author of Guapa. The novel's protagonist is a gay man living in the Middle East. But first, we'll hear from Emma Donahue. She's the author of the best-selling book Room, and she joined us to discuss her newest novel called The Wonder. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us today. We're spending time with three novelists, and we begin with Emma Donahue. She's the author of nine novels, most notably of Room, which was adapted to an Oscar-winning film of the same name. She joined me a few months ago to talk about her new book called The Wonder, which takes place in 19th century Ireland. The central character is an 11-year-old girl who has gained an extraordinary reputation for her fasting that's lasted for weeks. Let's take a listen. So tell us about these fasting girls. This is this is where you got started on this novel.
Yeah, Anna O'Donnell is a completely fictional character, but there are about 50 real cases that kind of haunt this book. They were known as the fasting girls or the miraculous maidens. And, you know, 50 is not many at all. This is 50 over about five centuries. They're found all over the Western world, and they weren't ever a homogenous group. They are basically people who hit the headlines for being apparently able to live without food. There'd be the occasional young man in there, occasionally an older woman, but most of them were girls or young women. And some of them were overtly religious. Some of them would say, you know, God feeds me, I don't need food. Some were Protestant, some were Catholic. And they all seem to have been Christian, as far as I know. But some of them didn't make any religious claims at all. They just said, it's amazing, I live on light or I live on air. So I see them as a kind of a recurrent cultural fantasy of ours.
Was there one case or one person, one girl in particular that you used for this story?
I drew on several, but the one I first heard about a good 20 years ago was a Welsh case called Sarah Jacob. And what horrified me about that case was that the media got involved, and in this sort of scientific spirit of the 19th century, they wanted to, you know, test whether the girl was a hoax or not. So they brought in nurses and they had the girl strictly watched, and she died. So in that case, clearly the experiment made what it was looking at worse. You know, the scientific observations somehow changed the terms of what was going on in that house, so the girl died. So I couldn't tell that story. It was too dark even for me. But it always stuck in my mind, and over the years I became aware of more and more cases. There was a famous one called Molly Fancher in Brooklyn, for instance. Some of these young women ended up, you know, in hospitals getting force-fed. Some of them were found out as hoaxes. Some of them were never found out and lived on for several decades claiming to be just fine without food. So there are a real mixture of cases. But with this particular story of Anna O'Donnell, I wanted to set it in 19th century Ireland, not just because Ireland is my own home country, but because the great famine of the 1840s is really part of our psyche. We are the people who survived famine. You know, we pride ourselves on that. So I really liked the idea of setting this story of voluntary hunger against the background of the involuntary hunger.
To create a kind of tension between this young girl who chooses not to eat in a country at that time where people were starving because they couldn't eat, that kind of tension?
Yes, and of course that's true of modern eating disorders too. That's the terrible paradox of them, that people can starve in a country where there are ample calories. It's two very different forms of hunger. And also the mid-19th century was a perfect time to set this story, because over the whole range of the last five centuries you see a lot of different explanations of these cases, and typically religious explanations dominated at the start. You know, if you were fasting in 1500, they would say, oh, you're probably a saint. If you're fasting in 1950, they would probably say you had a mental disorder. And in the mid-19th century, you could say any of these things. And, you know, you could also say that somebody was a medical anomaly. So there were lots of different ways of interpreting this kind of case. And I love the idea of this young child, Anna O'Donnell, who's only 11. You know, in a way, she's this little blank page. She's an enigma, and everybody has a different theory about her.
Well, it's the 21st century, so it's hard not to think about anorexia, the idea of denying yourself food. There's a certain weird kind of control and power, I think, that someone has when they deny themselves food. It's sort of a strange kind of power, because clearly they're weakening their own selves, but in doing that, controlling the world around them.
Absolutely. I'm very interested in the power of the powerless. And, you know, Anna O'Donnell, as a child in Victorian Ireland, you know, she'd never have a job, she'd never have a vote. Her prospects were really limited. But the idea that just by saying no to food, she could end up as a celebrity with, you know, visitors coming from other countries, people offering money. And you see that sometimes in situations nowadays of, say, reality TV, where people put themselves through horrendous experiences, yes, all to get famous, all to be in that spotlight. So I was fascinated by the psychology of Anna and of everyone around her as well, because, you know, if it takes a village to raise a child, I think it can take a village to damage one too. So I'm really interested in the kind of, you know, ethical ripple effect of this case and all the people in Anna's life, her parents, her relatives, her priest, her teacher, her doctor, all these people who are failing to save her until this outsider, Lib Wright, an English nurse, comes in. And Lib has been assigned simply to surveil Anna, you know, to be strictly neutral. But of course, as any medical professional will tell you, there's no
you
such thing as being strictly neutral.
Well, she's an interesting character, Lib, in that she's a nurse. She trained under Florence Nightingale. She served in the Crimean War. She's a widow. I mean, she has lived a hard life herself.
Yes, I wanted to give her an interesting background, which would make her, you know, feel equipped for any situation, right? She's the Nightingale nurses were an absolutely new breed. You know, nursing had been the most low job. It was like scullery maid. So to have served in the Crimean meant that you were suddenly part of a new batch of highly trained, zealous, idealistic professionals. And so Lib Wright is going to think that she's seen everything before, but she has not seen this, and she's baffled by the case. And it's partly because she's so English and educated and middle class and rational, she's actually not very well equipped to understand rural Ireland. Because, for instance, on the second day of the watch, she finds a saucer of milk under a dresser, and she thinks, aha, this is how the girl's being secretly fed. But no, it's milk that's been left out for the fairies, as any Irish person would have known. So, you know, she's a bit like a highly trained professional sent by an NGO to sub-Saharan Africa, and bewildered and making lots of mistakes because she doesn't have that cultural knowledge.
As I was reading your book, I was also thinking of those fairy tales, which are about eating, generally eating children. I'm thinking of Hansel and Gretel, Little Red Riding Hood. There are other stories as well about little children getting eaten by adults. And I don't know whether that figures into some of your writing or some of your
thinking. Fairy tales figure in all my writing. Yeah,
I figured.
I particularly like writing stories which are committed to realism. You know, they're a particular time and place. They're detailed. They're convincing. They're naturalistic, but they have something kind of archetypal as well. I like the idea of a legend or a fairy tale or some, you know, deeper story that could have happened any time, any place, a kind of throbbing underneath the surface of a particular realistic story.
And I remember reading fairy tales to my son when he was little and realizing sort of for the first time just how scary they were. As a little girl, I don't think I experienced them that way. But as an adult reading them to a child, you realize, whoa, what? And then you tell them to go to bed.
You know, but they want these stories.
They do, I mean, absolutely.
The oral tradition is like a great series of likes all through history. You know, if people didn't like these stories, they wouldn't have passed them on. So, yeah, I think it's no accident that a lot of stories focus on these sort of basic terrors of, do you starve in the woods? Do you get eaten up yourself? And the dangers of eating, even. I'm thinking of Persephone in the underworld. She has a couple of seeds and she's trapped there.
And also how, and this is not nearly as dramatic as what we've been talking about, but I think for every parent, when they find their child won't eat, I mean, just how infuriating that can be.
Oh, yeah.
You know, sometimes it goes on for more than a meal or two. Sometimes it seems like it goes on for days.
Yeah, and I mean, so many of us would say that, you know, that the parental job starts with feeding them even before they're born, you know, get food in them. I sometimes tease my kids by saying, listen, you know, you're made of me, right?
Right. But you did set this in this really terrible time in Irish history when the not just the potatoes went bad, but it was clear that the English were you know, sending crops overseas so that it just made it impossible for people to either live or even barely survive.
Yes, it's interesting. I tried to draw kind of a subtle parallel in this book between, you know, what's happening in this individual case where all these people are gathered around this girl and just sort of neutrally watching her. And of course, that neutrality, it's no such thing. So they're effectively letting her head towards death. But similarly with laissez-faire economics, you know, that Irish mass death was really brought on by British policies. So I was very aware that Ireland, that Anna can sort of stand for Ireland as well as for herself. Yeah, and in a sense, she can stand for all women as well. I mean, one scene that struck me as having very contemporary overtones is that there's a scene where the whole committee who've hired the nurse gather to discuss Anna's case. And there they are, you know, debating the rights and wrongs of what's happening. And nobody's stepping in to actually save the girl. And, you know, in Ireland, we have similar battles at the moment over things like reproductive choice. You know, Ireland still doesn't have reproductive freedom. So, you know, the idea of this committee of men weighing in on what they think should happen to the girl's body, you know, it's not dead and gone. So many of these issues are still alive and well.
And in many ways, this book is about this girl's body. It's wasting away. There's some sort of mystery about obviously why and how this is going on, how she can live and also not eat at the same time, which, of course, is impossible.
And I wanted to put the nurse in a peculiarly difficult position in that, you know, nurses in those days were particularly under the thumb of doctors. They were really not meant to take any independent decisions. They were, you know, meant to kind of cheer and help the patient as much as they could. But in this case, she's not allowed to do the most basic thing the girl needs, which is give her food. So she's really, she's a zealous nurse, but she's in the position of a prison guard. And then, you know, she finds herself, one doctor advises her to force feed the girl. So, you know, there are all these ethical miseries for her around this case, that she starts to really like this girl and want to help her but can't figure out how to do it. I really liked the idea that both the medical professionals and the media in this book both have to go through a similar dilemma, because there's a key character who's a journalist. And again, he's meant to be just reporting on the case, and he starts off very sort of cynical and worldly and just making fun of it as a nonsensical case. But he too starts to care. He starts to feel committed. And because he's an Irishman but a very rational and educated one, he's a kind of an interesting bridge between those two very, very distinct traditions of the superstition-bound Irish peasantry and the rational English. You know, he's a complicating factor.
And where are you between those two poles?
I'm much more of a skeptic, but on the other hand, I absolutely see how religion can buoy people up. You know, the sheer strength and uplift it could give to powerless people like the Irish peasantry in the 19th century. I mean, it was a religion that told them that, you know, the last would be first and the meek would rule, and that, you know, a little Irish girl might be as important as the Queen of England, and that all things would be reversed in the next life. So I can see how totally consoling it was, and it gave meaning to their days, meaning to all their sufferings and deaths, meaning to every sick or dying child. So I can absolutely see why they clung to it, but I can also see the sinister effect that it had when it became a system of, you know, groupthink, a system of rules and counting prayers and very, very petty rules.
Do you see Anna, this little girl, I mean, as sort of representing a kind of fanaticism that we sometimes see in religion?
Yeah, and a real, you know, a wasted opportunity. You know, she's an intelligent, idealistic young person. You know, she reminded me of teenagers who get radicalized and go off to join ISIS today.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah. I was very aware that, you know, you could have set this story in any cult or religious setting where the rules are very extreme. A girl in India has just died at 13 after a 68-day complete fast. You know, she's in the Jain tradition. So it's not just Catholicism. I could have set this story anywhere, but it seemed most honest to set it in my own cultural tradition. You know, if you're going to be saying really tough things about a culture, it might as well be your own.
And your faith, I know you were raised Catholic.
I'm not Catholic anymore, but it certainly marked me. Yeah. And I take religion very seriously. It's just that I hate fundamentalism in any form. You know, I hate when any system of rules, and, you know, it could be communism, it doesn't even have to be a religion, when any system of rules becomes so rigid that there's no room for the individual, or where there's no room for, you know, the body, for human needs, for human impulses and appetites.
That was my conversation with novelist Emma Donoghue about her novel, The Wonder, recorded last year. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from Salim Haddad, author of a novel called Guapa. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. We continue our show devoted to novelists with an interview with Salim Haddad. His debut novel, Guapa, is set over the course of one day in an unnamed Arab country. The central character, a young translator, is struggling with his homosexuality while living in a world dominated by Islam and political unrest. Let's take a listen.
Tell us about this grandmother.
So this grandmother, Teta, who is very much based on my own grandmother, who I am very close to, she is very typical of a certain type of woman of her generation who has been raised and grown up and lived through a certain type of Arab patriarchy for so long. And so in many ways, she's internalized a lot of these lessons. But she gets to a point when she is old enough that she simply doesn't care anymore. And she begins to exert her own power and becomes a bit of a matriarch. And, you know, I've seen women like this throughout the Middle East, and my grandmother is one of them. And, you know, and I've grown up under the shadow of one of these women. And so I have this reverence for this type of female character. And I really wanted to show how patriarchy can affect women in ways that might not necessarily be very obvious. You know, the standard idea of how women are oppressed in the region gives the sense of a submissive Arab woman. And I wanted to explore the impact of patriarchy through actually a very strong and domineering woman character.
So is tyrannical the wrong word for her?
I think there's an
From
element
your perspective?
Of her. I think there's an element of her that is definitely tyrannical. But there's also an element of hers that, of her that is, I think the tyranny is driven by, you know, her intense desire to protect Rasa. And her love for him and her idea of protecting him from all the dangers in society.
The book begins with the sentence, "The morning begins with shame." And this is Rasa's shame, realizing that his grandmother has peeked through the keyhole, seen him in bed, or thinks seen him in bed with another man.
Shame. And shame is a huge part in the novel. I've always been interested in exploring the idea of shame. It's played a big part in my own life. And my own upbringing, you know, shame is a way to police people's behavior in the Middle East, and it was a way that would police my own behavior, my own masculinity, so I really wanted to examine that.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section from the book, which is, in many ways, is about this shame that Rasa feels.
Okay. Taimur's name is embargoed under a cloak of Aib. The closest word for Aib in English is perhaps shame. But Aib is so much more than that. The implication of Aib is kalam an-nas, what people will say. And so the word carries an element of conscientiousness, a politeness brought about by a perceived sense of communal obligation. Aib is an old cloak that Teta draped across my shoulders many years ago. After Baba's death, she wove an intricate web for the two of us. In public, we were stoic, navigating social obligations like pros. When it was just us, unspoken words rotted in our mouths. Teta hid her grief behind a pinched nose, a tight smile, and her ever-growing list of aibs. It's aib not to go visit the neighbors during Eid. It's aib to miss a wedding, even if you hate every minute of it. It's aib to pick your nose in public. Accepting a second helping of food on the first offer? Aib, shoo, I don't feed you enough? It's aib to ask a woman how old she is, or to ask someone what religion they are. It's aib for a young boy to play with Barbie dolls. I've come to realize that if worn correctly, the cloak of Aib is large and malleable enough to allow you to conceal many secrets and to repel intrusive questions. For example, it's Aib to ask me my girlfriend's name if I don't offer it to you first. I suppose because of this secrecy, Taimur's name holds an unexplainable power over me. It's a name weighed down by secrets and implications, transformed into something much larger than its seven letters. I look forward to listening to people say the name with their unique inflections and tones. I analyze it, I spell it out. Sometimes I even whisper his name out loud when I can be certain nobody can hear. This satisfies me for some time, but it's never enough. No, I need others to say his name too. It makes the name real. It makes us real.
That's our guest, Salim Haddad, reading from his novel called Guapa. I mean, even the word, certainly in English, shame, is so shameful. I mean, there is something about just the way it sounds. Mm-hmm. Sounds like what it is. But there's also, as you write, something intriguing and forbidden that's buried in these shameful things.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And, I mean, I'm very interested in understanding how shame as a concept can be malleable and open to subversion, and that's something that I'm interested in doing. That I was interested in doing in the novel was explore characters who subvert the idea of what is and isn't shameful in order to make a room for themselves in their communities. But I'm also interested in the political implication of this on a broader level, especially when it comes to LGBT rights in the region, as another angle of LGBT pride, for example, is exploring also how we can expand the notion of shame in order to make room for queer people in Arab societies.
Also, one of the characters says that I guess being gay or even living with some of these secrets requires an Oscar-winning performance. I mean, to be able to sort of pretend otherwise, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that, to me, was the hardest part growing up. It was the performance of it. And, you know, when you get to a certain, or at least when I got to a certain level, I was tired of performing, and I didn't want to do it anymore. So when people often say, you know, especially, you know, in Europe or the U.S., oh, your life must have been under threat, I often say, well, it's not really that simple. It's more that I was sick of performing.
Uh-huh.
And many of my friends live very happy lives in this performance. And, you know, they're able to do this dance, the social dance, very well. I'm not one of them.
And the social dance is what, pretending otherwise? Or when someone says, are you getting married? You say yes, or maybe you even do get married.
You say inshallah.
Inshallah.
God
right.
willing. Yeah.
Yes. Right. As part of that performance.
Absolutely. And I mean, I have a friend of mine who has sadly passed away now, but he is gay, and he comes from a very conservative family in Lebanon, and he got married to a lesbian, and it was a huge performance. But they got married for their parents. Their parents were very happy. They then moved to the Gulf and lived together as housemates, you know, this amazing life. And they, for them, there was no ambiguity there. It was very clear that there was, you know, the public life, and then there was the private life, and the public performance of it.
Do you think that's, I mean, I think all people have a public and private performance and life, certainly true in this country. Do you think it's any more true in the Middle East?
I think the stakes are much higher in the Middle East, and that's the difference. I think in the Middle East, there's a lot more to lose. If you don't play the game or don't dance the dance.
Because it's a crime to be gay?
I think in some cases it's a crime. In some countries it's a crime to be gay, and in some countries there are no gay laws. But I think, and for me the very difficult part, and this links to the broader element and why I wanted to explore the Arab revolutions in the context of this novel, is because I find, you know, queer lives and the challenges queer people face to be intricately tied to the broader struggle for accountability, proper implementation of laws, the ability to speak out, and the fight for sort of freedom and dignity that the Arab Spring initially exemplified.
In part of that Arab Spring, were there sort of embedded in the calls for more freedoms, the freedom to be gay, to be out and gay in the Middle East?
No, I worked a lot after the Arab revolutions in Egypt and Yemen and Libya, speaking to a lot of youth activists and women activists, because we were doing work around transitional and peace processes, and the question of gay rights didn't come up. Even women's rights was a contested field. And I think when there were flourishes of gay rights activism within the context of the broader revolutions after 2011, they were quickly brushed aside as not a priority at the moment.
You write, or I guess Raza is saying here, what's the point of risking your life to remove a mask only to wear a different one? That would be like castrating donkeys. I circled that because I don't know that phrase about castrating donkeys. But I was intrigued by the first part as well, which is if you're not fighting for your rights, whose rights are you fighting for?
Mm-hmm. So the castrating donkeys phrase was when I was living in Jordan, and this was, you know, over 10 years ago now, I was riding in a taxi, much like Rasa did, and the taxi driver was very frustrated, and he said, you know, life these days feels like castrating donkeys.
Wow.
And I just really loved that phrase. So for, you know, 11 years, that phrase was sitting in my head until I found the perfect opportunity to use it in this book.
But the idea of a mask.
The idea of a mask, I think, you know, I wrote this novel while I was doing a lot of work around the Arab Spring. And initially when the protests first started in Tunisia and Egypt, I just remember feeling this overwhelming wave that, you know, our time had finally come and we were finally making our voices heard and we didn't have to act anymore. And, you know, as the year progressed, it was amazing for me to meet with all of these different types of Arab activists, you know, and I realized how small my world had been. And, you know, after years of not talking to one another, we were finally talking and we realized we didn't agree. And that was a very heartbreaking recognition. We thought it would be so easy that we would go out in the streets and we all had the same idea of what the future would bring. And finally, you know, after being united against something, we finally realized that we were actually fighting for different things. And so I think that's the struggle that Ras is talking about.
Guapa is not an Arabic word. It's actually a Spanish word. And this is this bar, this place where Raza and his friends hang out. Describe this place and why it's such a central part of this story.
In the Middle East, most young people, if not all young people, live with their parents until a very late age, until they get married. And so they don't often have a private space in their house. So it's really coffee shops and bars that are one of the few places where where young people can be themselves. And growing up in the Middle East, I remember having such a strong love for for these bars and coffee shops, because it was really one of the few places, if not the only places, where I could walk in and feel that I was, you know, I was in my a safe space. So I wanted, you know, this book about someone who's really trying to find his place in the world to have at its center point a bar like this that does allow him to be himself.
Are we talking gay bars? Or are we just talking bars where young people can congregate? Or does it matter?
I think it doesn't matter. I think a lot of these bars are bars where, you know, outcasts meet. And whether they're gay or whether they're political activists or whether they're simply sort of very outspoken women or feminists. I mean, these spaces are very politically important spaces. Mm. And so I think it transcends simply being gay.
Which leads to the obvious question, which is, I mean, at what point in your life did you either realize you were gay or think you were gay? Was it a process for you?
It was definitely a process, and it was a very long process. You know, I grew up in the Middle East, and you don't really see gay characters on television, or you don't read about them. And, you know, even at the time, I was watching a lot of American television. But in the 90s, you know, there were very few gay characters on even American television. So I didn't really have these role models or really anything to build my identity on. And I remember thinking when I was very young that it was a death sentence. And, you know, I would, much like Rasa himself says that, you know, he just felt that the only thing he could do was get married because it would please his family and live this life, sort of.
A double life or a kind of a shrunken life?
A very shrunken life and a very unhappy life. And when I went to Canada for university, I thought it was my opportunity to really explore my sexuality. But, it, you know, I arrived a few weeks before September 11th happened, and I suddenly discovered that actually there was this whole other identity that I had no idea existed, which is this Arab identity. Because after all, you know, growing up in the Middle East, everyone is an Arab, so you don't really understand anything about your Arab identity. But I was suddenly exposed to it in a very different way. And so funnily, it wasn't until I went back to the Middle East that I really felt I had the space to explore my gay identity and meet other people and go to bars like Guapa. And that was really how I began to come out.
Well, and I wonder whether, like Raza, leaving the Middle East, going somewhere else, in this case he goes to America, and then comes back, you begin to see things that perhaps were there, but you didn't recognize were either gay people or gay bars or a gay life.
Exactly.
You write, I'd come to America preparing myself to be like a character on those television shows. I was going to be Blossom's best buddy. I was going to have a coffee shop gang like in Friends. More than that, America was going to offer me the space to examine myself in something clearer than the foggy mirror in Teta's bathroom. But as you said, or as he says in this book, but what you confronted was something completely new mm-hmm. and different, your Arabness.
Mm-hmm.
So this was after September 11th. For you,
yes.
In Canada, I guess.
In Canada, yes. And it was, and this is something that's for a lot of Arabs of my age and a bit younger, you know, September 11th was a huge part of our identity. It was a way for us to understand our Arabness and our Muslimness in a completely different way. So I really felt that September 11th was a key part of Raza's own mm-hmm. identity and his way of understanding his identity.
In what way?
I think it, for many of us, you know, before 9/11, we took this Arab identity or this Muslim identity for granted. And after 9/11, I think we suddenly understood how, especially Western media, because I don't want to say Westerners in general, but Western media really picked up on a lot of elements that we had maybe not really considered, you know, things like, oh, well, how do you treat women? It's terrible. Or, you know, even how do you treat gay people? And, you know, you had this feeling that you were suddenly being picked apart, picked at from the inside, all of these things that you didn't really know or you didn't really think too much about. And so your own sense of self is then informed by all of these criticisms that others are making of yourself. And that can be quite traumatizing.
Were these legitimate criticisms to say, well, how do you treat gay people? How do you treat women?
I think perhaps some of them, definitely. But I think, and the challenge is that a lot of it lacked nuance. And, you know, and I wrote about this in my article in the Daily Beast about the challenges of even writing a queer Arab story when you're dealing with all of these different discourses. You know, you're battling oppressive forces within your own community,
right.
But you're also battling, you know, this wider global media that tries to use this oppression for political goals.
I mean, how do you resolve that if you're kind of living in the middle of it?
I think it's hard. And you know, and the Daily Beast article, I think, is my way of just saying, you know, writing the novel was my way to mm-hmm. to try and make sense of it. And even after having written the novel, I feel I'm closer to understanding it. But I'm not there. Yeah. I think it's a process.
You also wrote in that Daily Beast article about some degree of reluctance, for your family's sake, mm-hmm. For writing this novel. I don't know, were you outing them by writing a novel about a young gay man?
I don't think I was outing them, but I think my family still live in the Middle East. I mean, I spend half my time in the Middle East and half my time in London, but I now also have a foreign passport. And I realize that offers me an element of protection that my family don't have. Having said that, I don't think that they're under any threat. But it was, you know, it's always the vulnerability to any threat.
That was my interview with Salim Haddad about his debut novel, Guapa, recorded last year. When we get back from the break, we'll hear about Jamaica and colorism when we listen back to Mary Cummings Jordan's interview with author Nicole Dennis Benn. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. When most Americans visit the island of Jamaica, they go for the beautiful beaches, the reggae music, and delicious food. But beyond the gates of the many resorts is a country rife with a complicated form of racial discrimination called colorism. In her debut novel, Here Comes the Sun, author Nicole Dennis Benn depicts colorism's effect on the country and the impact that the tourism industry has on the Jamaican people. She joined Mary Cummings Jordan last year to talk about her book and her life in Jamaica. Let's listen.
So Nicole, before we dive into the novel and its four primary characters, let's get a sense of your story. You grew up in Kingston, Jamaica?
Yes, I did. So I was born and raised in Kingston, Jamaica, in a small town, Vineyard Town, Kingston 3. See, I'm actually speaking Jamaican here, Kingston 3. And it was a very great upbringing. You know, we had a lot, you know, our parents made sure to provide for us so that we weren't aware of the class differences until later on, which I know we'll discuss. But growing up, I had a great childhood. You know, it was all, you know, the huge garden, huge front yard, trees that we could climb, pick fruits, you know, and that was my most fond memories growing up in Kingston, Jamaica, in Vineyard Town.
Yes, it was beautiful.
It was beautiful.
Yeah. And you were slipping into what's called the patois?
Yes.
So now what is that to the culture of Jamaica, patois?
Very important. You know, it's so sad in that we are encouraged not to speak it in public.
By whom?
By our teachers, for sure. Well, of course, now there's a huge debate with the government, with the Ministry of Education, as to whether we should have patois being our second language or first language. Because it really is our first language, but because of we were colonized by the British, so we were, you know, forced to speak English language. And one thing is that when you speak to most Jamaicans, casually, it would be patois. We're speaking to each other. But in a professional setting, it would definitely be standard English. And standard mm-hmm. English is looked at, is also class-wise too, where you're more educated when you speak that language. Mm-hmm. And to me, though, a lot of children are in school who are in households who only speak patois in those households and come to school and expect to comprehend the standard English of the teacher. And so sometimes there's miscommunication there. You know, so a lot of our children, you know, end up not comprehending in that full sense, and they get criticized for being backwards for speaking it. Right. So in Here Comes the Sun, for example, you see Tandy going through that in that, you know, she was forced or, you know, she forces herself to only present herself that way.
Yeah.
And I went through that, too. You know, I went to a very elite high school in Kingston as well, St. Andrew High School for girls. And, you know, we were told not to speak this language. So it's just interesting how now I'm writing the dialogue that way.
Yes.
Even my own mother exclaimed to me and my siblings, like, oh, my gosh, Nikki, you're speaking patois in your book. And I'm like, yes, I still think in patois. You know, everything, my thought process is in patois. But when I speak, you know, I have make a mental note to it, to present it in standard English.
Yeah.
So that's why that slip just happened now, where the H was swallowed in three.
We don't mind.
Okay, awesome. Good.
And I was going to mention, much of the dialogue in the book is in patois.
Yes.
So which definitely, I feel, really gives you a sense of the culture.
Exactly.
In Jamaica. So let's get into the book. The novel is set in when, 1994?
1994, yes.
Okay. And one of the narratives is that of a love story between two women, Margot and Verdine. And tell us a bit about their story.
Yes. Yeah, so Margot and Verdine's story, very beautiful love story. You know, I wrote that because I really feel that Margot herself, yes, you know her character in grappling with her own identity and also upward mobility, her drive to, you know, aspire to get more from her own country. But Verdine came along, you know, Margot has always been in love with Verdine ever since, you know, she was a little girl. And so here are two women who literally grew up together and, you know, fell in love. And so because of the cultural norms, though, Margot struggles internally with embracing Verdine fully as her partner. And that's something, you know, realistically, you know, we're talking about 1994 here. We're talking about a working class woman who's Margot, who doesn't really see herself falling for this woman and, you know, even risking it being found out. And so that's something that I had to really write well between those two women.
Well, at least at the time, a couple of decades ago, homosexuality in Jamaica was not accepted.
Right. It's not. Still not accepted.
Still not.
Yeah.
I'd read that there were starting to be changes, but no.
No, not really. So I definitely always emphasize for individuals that it's a class dynamic. Is there something about you having access and money that prevents you from being subjected to anything negative that comes with being gay or lesbian in the country? Right. So, you know, back in 1994, yes, you probably might hear the stories or the disappearance of men who were found out to be gay, for example. No, I mean, you hear those stories, but it's not as much in that sense of like violence. But what's happening now in the country itself, because the gaze of of America and Europe looking to Jamaica as, oh my gosh, like it used to be, it is our paradise in the sense of tourism. Mm. And so a lot of individuals try hard to cover that up. You know, so, oh my gosh, like, they don't want other individuals saying we're homophobic, so they won't come to the island. So no, there's a movement to make it look like a flower bed for individuals, but it's not. Mm. You know, if you're a working class and you're impoverished and you're a gay or a lesbian, you're not going to survive if you're found out to be an openly gay.
It's dangerous.
It's dangerous, yes. Okay. Yes, unless if you're, I know there are lesbians and gays in like design and art. I mean, of course, in academia for sure. And those individuals can actually exist, but they're existing in a gated community, a very protected or insulated realm.
And you get into classism in depth in your book and in your characters. And I'd like you to read a passage for the book. This is it starts on page 201. And Dolores has a stall at the local market, and she makes a snap decision to prostitute Margot when Margot is not quite 14.
One day, a tall, dark-haired man walked into Dolores' stall. He was wearing sunglasses, like most tourists. He had a presence about him, an air Dolores associated with important people, white people, like the ones who just bought out her stall. Except the man wasn't white. A mixture, maybe, a mulatto kind. He wore a button-down shirt that revealed the dark hairs on his chest. When Dolores peered up at him, she saw he was peering down at Margot. He turned to Dolores, his eyes hidden behind the shades. "How much?" he asked in a voice that sounded to Dolores like thunder. "The dolls are 20, sir." "Oh, and the figurines go for 15. U.S. "But I can give you for 10. And the T-shirts, they're unique, sir. Only one of a kind. Only $15. "No," the man said, returning his focus to Margot. "I'm talking about her." He used his pointed chin to gesture to a skinny Margot, who at the time had barely started menstruating or growing breasts. Dolores looked from her daughter to the tall stranger wearing the sunglasses. "She's not on sale, sir." The man pulled out a wad of cash and began to count it in front of Dolores. Dolores watched him count 600 bills. She had never seen so much money in her life. The crispness of the bills and the scent of newness, which Dolores thought was what wealth must smell like. The possibility of moving her family out of Riverbank, affording her daughter's school fee, books and uniforms, buying a telephone and a landline, for her to call people whenever she liked instead of waiting to use the neighbor's phone. All these possibilities were too much to swallow all at once. "Sir, but she's only 14. "I'm staying right down there," he gestured to the large cruise ship, which was in plain sight. "I'll have her back before dinner." The man placed the bills in front of Dolores. She tore her eyes away from the stack to look into the terrified eyes of her daughter. Margot was shaking her head slowly, mouthing no. But Dolores had made up her mind the minute the scent of the bills hit her. Her eyes pleaded with her daughter's and also held in them an apology. "Please understand. Do it now and you'll thank me later." Dolores hoped her eyes communicated. She nodded to the man when Margot looked away defeated. The man took Margot somewhere. Dolores didn't ask where. It was in the direction of the ship that had docked for the day. The girl followed behind him, her steps uncertain. She never looked back to see the tears in Dolores' eyes.
So throughout the book, Dolores is a terribly unsympathetic character. She's cold, she's calculating, although you sense in that passage that, you know, she cared about her child. But is this something that happens with some frequency among the very poor?
Dolores really loves her daughters. That's the thing, you know, and over again in the book, or she stated once in the book, she's a good mother. In her eyes, she's a good mother by doing whatever it takes to provide for her children, even if it's selling Margot at that time. Dolores also loves her daughters so much that she would be the first one to tell them, listen, you know, the world is not going to love you, you know, as black girls or as girls who are of our class. So, You know, either you know it now or you move into the world and find out from someone else or other people. And so, you know, that's the love, the kind of love Dolores has. And in terms of poverty and what mothers will go through, yes, there are definitely women on that on the North Coast, for example, who this is actually, and not even only on the North Coast, even in Kingston, mm-hmm. Who will sell their bodies, you know, for money.
Sure.
And I mean, it happens all over the world, too. But I was really mostly aware of it returning back to the island and seeing for myself, you know, the level of like where these women would actually go to make money.
And Tandy thinks she also has to lighten her skin.
Yes.
In order to achieve that. You tackle colorism, the prejudice against skin shade, among at least in the culture in Jamaica. Dolores telling Tandy at one point, remember this, nobody loves a black girl, although that's said in patois, which
yes.
I'm not going to attempt. So so Tandy decides to get her skin lightened, which Charles, first of all, disapproves of, but it also is such a dangerous practice. So Tandy walks around for quite a long time in discomfort with this
yes.
chemical concoction on her skin and with the saran wrap.
Exactly. And then the sweatshirt over that
to hide
as well.
It.
Exactly.
To hide what she's doing. Colorism isn't unique to Jamaica, of course, but it seems that in our country, the concept of beauty is shifting. Do you see colorism beginning to fade in Jamaica?
Yes. No, it has been. In the sense of, well, let me explain why I say that. Because right now, the girls who are coming here, the high fashion models in Jamaica, now they're actually, you know, dark skin, right? And, you know, on the darkest side. But before that, a lot of our Miss Jamaica Universe and Miss World currently are actually white Jamaicans or the mixture that's mostly lighter skin. And so it's really, no, little girls are looking to those girls, Miss Universe, Miss World, as the epitome of beauty. And to me, that's problematic because, you know, their pictures are on the calendar. They're everywhere. So these little girls are looking at this saying, oh, my gosh, I'm not beautiful because I don't look like them. I don't have hair like that.
Sure.
And so that's
good
still
hair,
good hair.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's still rampant. That's still something that's prevalent on the island right now.
It just seems such a cruel narrative to teach a young girl coming up and something hard to carry for the rest of your life. You feel less than.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I personally have, you know, growing up, you know, I was one of those black girls, those dark skinned black girls who felt like, wow, I'm not seeing myself on screen. I'm not seeing myself represented as Miss Jamaica Universe, Miss Jamaica World. So what is that saying to me?
And what did it say to you?
It actually said that we weren't attractive enough. Yes, we were educated. We were intelligent. Because one thing, I listened to a lot of conversations about why girls like us don't get chosen to represent the country. And one of the biggest things that you'll hear is that, oh, because we weren't educated in the schools that those girls were educated in, that means we're not articulate enough. And I am saying to myself, but wait, I went to St. Andrew High School for Girls. There are so many girls on the islands who had gone to these great schools and, you know, still the same results. They're not regarded as the Miss Jamaica Worlds or Miss Jamaica Universe. And I mean, the only truth in that statement, though, is that a lot of darker skinned Jamaicans, you know, the working class impoverished Jamaicans, they're disenfranchised. You know, they don't have the education. And just to speak to what Tandy's doing with the bleaching, that's very prevalent in Jamaica as well.
To this day.
Hmm. Yes. And now it has even gotten more because now the creams are imported from various places like Europe, for example, or even the US. Then it's not tested. And these girls and boys would rub their skin thinking that they can actually have the access that the upper class have by having those that lighter skin. So it's really the desperation.
Were you ever tempted to do that?
I was.
Sure.
I was. You know, there was this skin cream called Naniola back in the day. I'm not sure it still exists on the market. Mm-hmm. But that was a cream. People used to use it on their elbows, you know, because, you know, if they're they're very concerned about their elbows or knees getting darker than their skin. But a lot of girls, you know, of my hue, you know, they would rub it on. And so back in high school, I went to the high school where, you know, a lot of us, we were looking at girls who were, you know, lighter skin with the quote-unquote long hair.
Sure.
And saying to ourselves, oh, how is that possible? How can you achieve that? Not realizing that it's all genetics. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying this now wearing my dreadlocks and loving my beautiful dark complexion.
So you're happy in
right.
your skin.
Yes, yes. But back then, it was a terrible message that was being sent to darker skinned working class girls.
So you are
and boys.
A darker skinned woman and you are married to a woman. And
yes.
Do these factors contribute to your leaving Jamaica?
No, multiple factors. Well, you did mention, yes. So class wise, yes. I felt if I had stayed in Jamaica, I would not have had the prospects I have right now. You know, yes, I could have ended up at the University of West Indies for sure, but I would have probably graduated and still not be able to rise up, to leave my working class status at all. I have friends there who have graduated from the university. They're working as security guards or they're working in jobs that they don't want to work because they don't have the family name or the connections to, let's say, do something that they really want to do. And to me, that's something that's, it's really saddening as well.
That was Mary Cummings Jordan's interview with novelist Nicole Dennis-Benn about her book, Here Comes the Sun, recorded last year. And that rounds out the novelist edition of Radio Times in Review. We hope you enjoyed it. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Trine Nuri, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.